Cat and Mouse. In Moscow, Gordievsky checked the locks again, praying he might be mistaken. But no, the third lock, the deadbolt he never used and had no key for, had been turned. The KGB was onto him. "This is it," he thought, as a trickle of fear sweat ran down his back. "I will soon be a dead man." At a time of the KGB's choosing, he would be arrested, interrogated until the last secret had been wrung out of him, and then killed. The ultimate punishment. An executioner's bullet in the head and an unmarked grave. But as his horrified thoughts raced and skidded, Gordievsky's training began to kick in. He knew how the KGB worked. If Directorate K had uncovered the full extent of his espionage, he would never have reached his own front door. He would have been arrested at the airport, and would now be in the basement cells of the Lubyanka. The KGB spied on everyone. Perhaps the break-in at his flat was just routine snooping. Clearly, if he was under suspicion, the investigators did not yet have sufficient evidence to nail him. Paradoxically, given its lack of moral restraint, the KGB was an intensely legalistic organization. Gordievsky was now a KGB colonel. He could not simply be detained on suspicion of treachery. There were strict rules about torturing colonels. The shadow of the purges of 1936-38, when so many innocents had perished, still lingered. In 1985, evidence needed to be gathered, a trial held, and sentence duly passed. The KGB investigator, Viktor Budanov, was doing exactly what MI5 had done with Michael Bettany, and what every effective counterintelligence agency does, watching the suspect, listening, waiting for him to make a mistake or contact his handler before pouncing. The difference was this. Bettany did not know he was under surveillance, and Gordievsky did, or thought he did. But he still needed to get into the flat. One of the other residents of the block was a KGB locksmith with a set of tools, and happy to help a neighbor and fellow officer who had lost his key. Once inside the apartment, Gordievsky discreetly checked for any other evidence of a KGB visit. Doubtless, the place was now bugged. If the technicians had planted cameras, they would be watching his behavior carefully for suspicious signs, such as searching for bugs. From now on, he must assume that his every word was being heard, his every move watched, his every telephone call recorded. He must behave as if nothing was out of the ordinary. He must appear calm, casual and confident. Everything, in fact, that he was not. The flat seemed tidy. In the medicine cabinet he found a box of wet wipe tissues, sealed with a foiled top. Someone had pushed a finger through the seal. It could have been Layla, he told himself. The hole could have been there for years. Or it could have been a KGB searcher, poking around for clues. In a box under his bed were books by authors that the Soviet censors would consider seditious. Orwell, Solzhenitsyn, Maximov. Lyubimov had once advised him that displaying these on open shelves was a risk. The box appeared undisturbed. Gordievsky cast an eye along the bookshelf and noted that the OUP edition of Shakespeare's sonnets was still in place, apparently intact. When he called his boss at home, Gordievsky thought Nikolai Gribin sounded odd. There was no warmth or enthusiasm in his voice. He barely slept that night, fears and questions swirling. Who had betrayed me? How much did the KGB know? The next morning he made his way to the center. He did not detect any surveillance, which by itself meant nothing. Gribin met him at the third department. His manner seemed almost normal, but not quite. "You'd better start preparing," Gribin remarked. "The two big bosses are going to summon you for a discussion." They spoke desultorily of what Chebrikov and Kruchkov might be expecting to learn from the new London resident. Gordievsky said he had brought extensive notes, as instructed, on Britain's economy, relations with the US, and developments in science and technology. Gribin nodded. An hour later he was summoned to the office of Viktor Krushko, now deputy head of the first chief directorate. Usually so affable, the Ukrainian seemed tense and relentlessly inquisitive. "What about Michael Bettany?" he asked. "It looks as though he was a real man after all, and seriously wanted to cooperate with us. He could have become a second Philby." "Of course he was real," Gordievsky replied, "and he would have been far better than Philby, much more valuable. A wild exaggeration. But how did we make such a mistake? Grushko pressed him. Was he genuine from the start? I thought so. I can't imagine why Comrade Gook didn't agree. A pause before Grushko continued. Gook was expelled, but he hadn't done anything about Bettany. He hadn't even made contact. So why did they sack him? Something in Grushko's expression made Gordievsky's stomach lurch. I think his mistake was to behave too much like a KGB man, always driving around in his Mercedes, boasting about the KGB and playing the general. The Brits didn't like that. The subject was dropped. A few minutes later, the officer appointed to greet Gordievsky at the airport was summoned by Grushko and loudly upbraided for his inefficiency. What happened? You were supposed to meet Gordievsky and bring him home. Where were you? The man stammered that he had gone to the wrong part of the airport. The scene seemed stage-managed. Had the KGB deliberately failed to send anyone to greet him in order to follow his movements on arrival? Gordievsky returned to his office, fiddled with his notes, and waited for the summons from the KGB boss that would indicate he was safe, or the tap on his shoulder from the counterintelligence section that would mean the end. Neither came. He went home to spend another evening of wondering, another night of fearful imagining. The next day was the same. Gordievsky might have been bored had it not been for the dread inside. On the third day, Gribbin said he was leaving work early and offered a lift in his car. What if a summons comes and I've gone? Asked Gordievsky. There's no chance of them sending for you tonight, replied Gribbin. As they crawled through the traffic in the rain, Gordievsky remarked, as casually as he could, that important work needed to be done in London. If there is nothing to detain me in Moscow, I would like to get back to deal with it. There is an important NATO meeting coming up, and the parliamentary year is ending. Some of my people need guidance with running contacts. Gribbin waved his hand, a little too airily. Oh, nonsense. People are often away for months at a time. Nobody's indispensable. The next day was played out with the same mixture of inner turmoil and external charade, as was the next. A strange, deceptive dance was underway, with both Gordievsky and the KGB pretending to be in step, while waiting for the other to trip up. The strain was unremitting and unshared. He could detect no surveillance, yet a sixth sense told him eyes and ears were everywhere, on every corner, in every shadow. Big Brother was watching him. Or, more precisely, the man at the bus stop was watching him, the neighbor on the street, the babushka with her samovar in the lobby, or perhaps not. As the days passed without incident, Gordievsky began to wonder if his fears were imaginary. Then came proof they were not. In a corridor of the third department, he bumped into a colleague from Directorate S, responsible for the illegals network, named Boris Bocharov, who hailed him. Oleg! What is happening in Britain? Why have all the illegals been pulled out? Oleg struggled to disguise his shock. The order to stand down the deep cover spies could only mean one thing. The KGB knew it had been compromised in the UK and was urgently dismantling its illegals network. Dario, the recipient of the cash-filled brick, had lasted less than a week as an undercover spy in London. He has never been identified. A strange parcel was waiting on Gordievsky's desk, addressed for Mr. Grushko's eyes only. It had arrived in the diplomatic bag from the London Residentura, and since Gordievsky was now the London resident, the clerks had assumed he was the logical first recipient. Hands trembling, he shook the parcel and heard a dry rattle and the tinkle of a buckle from within. This was surely his own satchel, which he had left on his desk in London, containing a number of important papers. The KGB was gathering evidence. Keep calm, he told himself, behave normally. He passed the parcel to Grushko's office and returned to his desk. People say that when soldiers hear the artillery start, they go into a sort of panic. That is what happened to me. I could not even remember the escape plan, but then I thought, the plan is unreliable anyway. I should forget about it, and just look forward to the bullet in the back of the neck. I was paralyzed. That evening, he placed a call to the Kensington flat. Layla answered. Recording devices in both London and Moscow clicked on. "How are the children doing at school?" he asked, enunciating clearly. Layla, detecting nothing unusual, replied that the girls were doing fine. They chatted for a few minutes and then Gordievsky rang off. Gribin, all bogus bonhomie, invited Gordievsky to stay in his dacha for the weekend. Clearly he was under instructions to stick closely to his underling in case he let anything slip. Gordievsky politely declined the invitation, explaining that he had not yet visited his mother and sister, Marina, since his return to Moscow. Gribin was insistent they meet, and announced that he and his wife would visit Gordievsky at home. For several hours, sitting around a fake marble-topped coffee table, they talked of life in London, how the girls were growing and speaking English as a first language. His daughter, Maria, had even learned the Lord's Prayer in English. To a casual listener, Gordievsky might have been a proud father describing the pleasures of a foreign posting to an old and close colleague over a friendly cup of tea. In reality, a brutal, unacknowledged psychological fistfight was taking place. By Monday morning, May 27th, Gordievsky was ragged from sleeplessness and strain. Before leaving home, he swallowed one of Veronica Price's PEP pills, a non-prescription caffeine-based booster often used by students trying to stay alert during all-night study sessions. By the time he reached the center, Gordievsky was feeling better, the edge taken off his exhaustion. He had been seated at his desk only a few minutes when the phone rang, the dedicated line from the office of the department head. Gordievsky felt a small surge of hope. Perhaps the long-awaited meeting with the KGB chiefs was at hand. "Is it the bosses?" he asked when Viktor Grushko came on the line. "Not yet," said Grushko, blandly. "There are two people who want to discuss high-level agent penetration in Britain with you." The meeting place, he added, would be outside the building. Grushko would be coming too. This was all highly unusual. Apprehension rising, Gordievsky left his briefcase on the desk and headed down to the lobby. Grushko appeared a moment later and ushered him into a car parked at the curbside. The driver swung out of the rear gates and, after less than a mile, stopped beside a high-walled compound used to house the visitors and guests of the First Chief Directorate. Chatting amiably, Grushko led Gordievsky to a small bungalow, a benign-looking building surrounded by a low picket fence, and apparently unguarded. The day was already muggy and hot, but inside it felt cool and airy. Bedrooms led off a long central room, sparsely but elegantly furnished with new furniture. At the door stood two stewards, a man in his 50s and a younger woman. Both greeted Gordievsky with extreme deference, as if he were a visiting foreign dignitary. When they were seated, Grushko produced a bottle. "Look, I've got some Armenian brandy," he said cheerfully, and poured out two glasses. They drank. The servants laid out plates and a platter of sandwiches, cheese, ham, and red salmon caviar. At this moment, two men entered the room. Gordievsky did not recognize either of them. The older, in a dark suit, had the lined and leathery face of a heavy drinker and smoker. The younger man was taller, with a long face and pointed features. Neither smiled. Grushko made no introductions, other than to say that the two men want to talk to you about how to run a very important agent in Britain. Gordievsky's anxiety rose another notch. "I thought, this is nonsense. There is no important agent in Britain. There is some other reason for all this." Grushko carried on blithely. "Let's eat first," he said, as if hosting a convivial working lunch. The male servant poured more brandy. The men drained their glasses and Gordievsky followed suit. Another bottle appeared. Another round was poured and drunk. The strangers made the smallest of small talk. The older man chain-smoked. Then, with shocking suddenness, Gordievsky felt his reality lurch into a hallucinatory dream world, in which he seemed to be observing himself, only half-conscious from far away, through a refracting, warping lens. Gordievsky's brandy had been spiked with some sort of truth serum, probably a psychotropic drug manufactured by the KGB known as SP-117, a form of sodium thiopental containing a fast-acting barbiturate anesthetic without smell, taste, or color, a chemical cocktail designed to erode the inhibitions and loosen the tongue. While the attendant had poured the other three men drinks from the first bottle, Gordievsky's glass had been surreptitiously filled from a different one. The older man was General Sergei Golubev, the head of Directorate K, the KGB branch in charge of internal counterintelligence. The other was Colonel Viktor Budanov, the KGB's top investigator. They began to ask questions, and Gordievsky found himself answering them, only dimly aware of what he was saying. Yet some parts of his brain were still self-aware and defensive. "Stay alert," he told himself. Gordievsky was now fighting for his life, in a miasma of sweat and fear, through a haze of drugged brandy. He had heard the KGB sometimes use drugs to extract secrets rather than physical torture, but he was wholly unprepared for this sudden chemical assault on his nervous system. Gordievsky could never explain exactly what happened over the next 5 hours. Yet he later recalled scraps, like the half-remembered shards of some shattering nightmare, assembled through a pharmacological fog. Suddenly vivid scenes, snatches of words and phrases, the looming faces of his interrogators. Of all people, Kim Philby, the elderly British spy still living in Moscow exile, came to his aid. "Never confess," Philby had advised his KGB students. As the psychoactive drug took a grip, Philby's words came back. "Like Philby, I was denying everything. Deny, deny, deny. It was instinctive." Budanov and Golubev seemed to want to talk about literature, Orwell and Solzhenitsyn. "Why do you have all these anti-Soviet volumes?" they demanded. "You deliberately used your diplomatic status to import things you knew were illegal." "No, no," Gordievsky heard himself say. "As a political intelligence officer, I needed to read books like that. They gave me essential background." Suddenly, here at his side was Grushko, all smiles. "Well done, Oleg. You're having an excellent conversation. Carry on. Tell them everything." Then he was gone again, and the two interrogators were leaning over him once more. "We know you are a British agent. We have irrefutable evidence of your guilt. Confess. Priznoysha." "No. I've nothing to confess." Slumped and soaked in sweat, he felt himself slip in and out of consciousness. Budanov, with the soothing voice one might use to a recalcitrant child, "You confessed very well a few minutes ago. Now please go through it again and confirm what you said. Confess again." "I've done nothing," he pleaded, clinging to his lie like a drowning man. At some point, he recalled lurching to his feet, rushing to the bathroom and vomiting violently into the basin. The two attendants seemed to stare at him nastily from a corner of the room, all deference gone. He asked for water and drank greedily, spilling it down his shirt front. Grushko was there one moment and gone the next. The interrogator seemed alternately consoling and accusatory, sometimes gently admonishing him. "How can you, a communist, be proud of your daughter being able to say the Lord's Prayer?" The next moment trying to trap him, reeling off the names of spies and defectors by their code names. "What about Vladimir Vetrov?" Budanov demanded, referring to the KGB officer executed a year earlier for collaborating with French intelligence. "What do you think of him?"
"I don't know what you're talking about," said Gordievsky.
Then Golubev played his trump card. "We know who recruited you in Copenhagen," he growled. "It was Richard Bromhead."
"Nonsense. That's not true."
"But you wrote a report about him."
"Of course, I met him once.
And I wrote a report of the meeting, but he never focused on me particularly. He used to talk to everybody." Budanov tried another tack. "We know that your telephone call to your wife was a signal to the British intelligence service. Just admit it."
"No,"
he insisted.
"That is not true."
"Deny, deny, deny." The two interrogators refused to let up. "Confess," they said. "You've done it once already. Confess again." Sensing his willpower waning, Gordievsky summoned up a spark of defiance and told the two KGB questioners they were no better than Stalin's secret police, extracting false confessions from the innocent. 5 hours after the first sip of brandy, the light in the room seemed to fade suddenly. Gordievsky felt a deathly fatigue engulf him. His head tipped back, and the spy slipped into the black. Gordievsky awoke in a clean bed, with morning sunlight streaming through the window, dressed only in an undershirt and underpants. His mouth was dust dry, and his head ached with a savage intensity he had never experienced before. For a moment he had no idea where he was, or what had happened. But then, slowly, in fragments, with growing horror, some of the events of the previous day began to filter back. A wave of nausea struck as he levered himself upright in bed. "I'm finished," he thought. "They know everything." But set against that conclusion was one self-evident fact suggesting the KGB might not know quite everything. He was still alive. The male attendant, obsequious once more, arrived with coffee. Gordievsky drank cup after cup. Head still throbbing, he climbed into his suit, hung neatly by the door. He was tying his shoes when the two interrogators reappeared. Gordievsky braced himself. Had the coffee been drugged? Was he about to descend back into that chemical fog? But no. His misted brain seemed clearer by the moment. The two men looked at him quizzically. "You've been very rude to us, Comrade Gordievsky," said the younger man. "You accused us of reviving the spirit of 1937, the Great Terror." Budanov's manner was sullenly resentful. Gordievsky's accusation that he was no better than a Stalinist butcher had offended his sense of legal propriety. He considered himself an investigator, an upholder of the rules, a seeker after truth, an inquirer, not an inquisitor, dealing in facts, not falsehoods. "What you said wasn't true, Comrade Gordievsky, and I'll prove it." Gordievsky was stunned. He had expected his interrogators to display the triumphant swagger of hunters who had trapped their quarry and would now go in for the kill. Instead, they seemed aggrieved and frustrated. Through his befuddlement, Gordievsky experienced a sudden clarity, and with it, a little surge of hope. The two interrogators, he realized, had not gotten what they wanted. "If I have been rude, I apologize," he stammered. "I don't remember." There was an awkward silence. Then Budanov spoke again. "A car is coming to take you home." An hour later, disheveled and bemused, Gordievsky found himself outside the apartment on Leninsky Prospect. Once again he was locked out, having left his keys on his office desk, so once again the locksmith neighbor had to let him in. It was now mid-morning. Gordievsky collapsed in a chair, more conscious than ever of being watched, and tried to recall the events of the night before. His interrogator seemed to know about Richard Bromhead. They also seemed to have realized that his call to Layla was a tip-off to British intelligence. But they clearly did not, yet, know the full magnitude of his espionage. He was certain that, despite their angry demands for a confession of guilt, he had stuck to his denials. The truth serum had not worked properly. Perhaps the single pep pill he had swallowed that morning had been enough to counteract the full effects of the sodium thiopental, a fortuitous side effect that Veronica Price had never envisaged when she gave them to him. Even so, any lingering hope that he was still above suspicion had now evaporated. The KGB was on his trail. The interrogators would be back. As the after effects of the drugs ebbed, the nausea was replaced by a steadily rising panic. By the middle of the afternoon, he could take the tension no longer. He called Grushko at the office and tried to sound normal. "I'm sorry if I was rude to those fellows, but they were very strange," he said. "No, no," said Grushko. "They're excellent chaps." Next he called Kribin, his department head. "Something extraordinary has happened, and I'm very worried," said Gordievsky. He described being taken to the little bungalow, meeting the two strangers, and then passing out. He pretended to remember nothing of the interrogation. "Don't worry, old chap," said Kribin, lying silkily. "I'm sure it's nothing important." Back in London, Layla was beginning to wonder why her husband had not called again. Then came the explanation. On the morning of May 28th, an official from the embassy arrived unannounced at the flat. Oleg had been taken ill, he explained. A minor heart problem. "It's nothing too serious, but you will have to go back to Moscow immediately with the girls. The embassy chauffeur will be coming to collect you. As the wife of the resident, you will be flying first class. Take only hand luggage, as you will all be returning to London very soon." Layla packed hurriedly while the official waited in the hall. "I was worried for Oleg, of course. Why had he not called himself to reassure me that he was okay? That was odd. Perhaps the heart problem was more serious than the official was letting on. The girls were excited to be going on a surprise holiday to Moscow. They were all waiting at the front door when the embassy car pulled up. After an almost sleepless night, Gordievsky dressed, took two more pep pills, and headed for the center, pretending this was just another working day, knowing it might be his last. He had been seated at his desk just a few minutes when the phone rang and he was summoned, once more, to Grushko's office. There, ranged behind a massive desk, a KGB tribunal was waiting. On either side of Grushko sat Gribin, stone-faced, and Golubev, the chief of Directorate K. Gordievsky was not invited to sit. A remarkable piece of espionage theatre now ensued. "We know very well you've been deceiving us for years," declared Grushko, like a judge passing sentence. "Yet we've decided that you may stay in the KGB. Your job in London is terminated. You'll have to move to a non-operational department. You should take any holiday you are owed. The anti-Soviet literature in your home must be delivered to the library of the First Chief Directorate. Remember, in the next few days, and forever, no telephone calls to London." Grushko paused, and then added in a tone that was almost conspiratorial, "If only you knew what an unusual source we heard about you from." Gordievsky was stunned and momentarily speechless. The very oddity of the scene seemed to call for some dramatic performance on his part. Adopting an air of bafflement that was only half feigned, he said, "I'm terribly sorry about what happened on Monday. I think there was something wrong with the drink or with the food. I was in a bad way. I felt awful." Golubev, the interrogator, seemed to wake up at this point and asserted, surreally, "Nonsense. There was nothing wrong with the food. It was delicious. The sandwiches with the salmon roe were excellent, and so were the ones with ham." Gordievsky wondered if he might be hallucinating again. Here he was being accused of treason, and the chief investigator was defending the quality of KGB sandwiches. Gordievsky addressed Grushko. "Viktor Fyodorovich, as to what you say about my deceiving you for a long time, I really don't know what you're talking about. But whatever your decision, I'll accept it like an officer and gentleman." And then, radiating injured innocence and soldierly honor, he turned and marched out. Back at his desk, Gordievsky felt his head spinning. He had been accused of working for an enemy intelligence service. KGB officers had been shot for doing far less. Yet they were keeping him on the payroll and telling him to take a holiday. A moment later, Gribin entered his office. During the weird scene in Grushko's office, he had not uttered a word. Now he looked sadly at Gordievsky. "What can I say to you, old chap?" Gordievsky sensed a trap. "Kolya, I don't know exactly what this is all about, but I suspect I've been overheard saying something critical about the party leaders, and now there's a big intrigue going on." "If only it was that," said Gribin. "If only it was a question of some indiscretion recorded by the microphones. But I'm afraid it's far, far worse than that." Gordievsky adopted a look of fresh bewilderment. "What can I say?" Gribin looked at him hard. "Try to take it all philosophically." It sounded like a death sentence. Back at the flat, Gordievsky tried to make sense out of what had taken place. The KGB did not go in for clemency. If they knew even a fraction of the truth, he was doomed. But the fact that he was not yet in the Lubyanka basement could only mean that the investigators still lacked decisive proof of his guilt. For the moment, I could not tell what the KGB had or had not found out, but it was clear that I was, in effect, under sentence of death, even if that sentence was suspended pending further investigations. The KGB was running a long game. "They've decided to play with me," he thought, "like a cat with a mouse. Eventually the cat gets bored with the game and either frightens the mouse to death or kills it." Viktor Budanov had a point to prove. Gordievsky believed Veronica's pep pill had saved him, but in fact it might have been his defiant remark in mid-interrogation, comparing the investigators to Stalin's killers, that explained why he was still alive. Budanov had been nettled by that suggestion. He wanted proof. He would let Gordievsky think he was safe, but keep him under surveillance until he cracked, confessed, or tried to contact MI6, at which point Budanov would swoop. There was no reason for haste, since there was nowhere for the man to run to. No suspected spy had ever escaped from the Soviet Union while under KGB surveillance. Normally, the Seventh Directorate would have used its own surveillance personnel to follow a suspect, but in this case, it was agreed to use a team from the FCD. Grushko had been insistent. Since this was his department's problem, his department would solve it, and the fewer people outside the directorate who knew what was happening, the better. For Grushko's career, among other things. The surveillance could not be people Gordievsky might recognize, and so a surveillance team from the Chinese department was seconded for the job. They were not told exactly who the suspect was, or what he was suspected of doing. They were merely told to follow him, report his movements, and not let him out of their sight. Once Gordievsky's family was back in Moscow, there was even less chance he might try to abscond. Leila and the two girls would be held as hostages. A second daytime break-in was staged at Gordievsky's flat, and his shoes and clothes were sprayed again with radioactive dust that was invisible to the naked eye, but that could be seen with special glasses and tracked using an adapted Geiger counter. Wherever he went, Gordievsky would now be leaving a radioactive trail. Woodenough was disappointed that the truth drug had not worked properly, though it seemed that Gordievsky had no memory of what had been said during the interrogation. The investigation was proceeding as planned. In London, the Nocton team was by now deeply alarmed. "It was a very long 2 weeks," said Simon Brown. MI5 reported that Gordievsky had called his wife from Moscow, but the conversation had not been fully recorded, and the eavesdroppers had failed to note whether Gordievsky had made the all-important reference to his daughter's schooling. Had Gordievsky signaled that he was in trouble? There was not enough evidence to draw a firm conclusion. When the senior MI6 officer liaising with the MI5 eavesdropping team was asked how the alarm raised by Gordievsky could possibly have been missed, he offered a quotation from Horace. "Indignor quandoque bonus domitat Homerus," often translated as, "even Homer nods." The most highly trained experts can still be caught napping. Then came the hammer blow. The security service reported that Leila Gordievsky and her two children were booked on a flight to Moscow. "When I heard that, my blood turned cold," recalled Brown. The sudden recall of Gordievsky's family could mean only one thing. He was in the hands of the KGB, and it was impossible to intervene. Stopping them traveling would have been a death sentence for him. An urgent cable was dispatched to the MI6 Moscow station with instructions to be on high alert for the activation of Operation Pimlico. But within the London team, there was deep pessimism and a widespread assumption that the case was over. Once the family was brought back to Moscow, it seemed certain that Gordievsky had already been arrested. Escape seemed exceptionally unlikely. The spy had been found out. But how? What had gone wrong? Brown recalled, "It was an awful time. The whole Nocton team was in shock. I stopped going into the office because everyone was walking around like zombies. As time went on, I convinced myself we'd got it hopelessly wrong, and Oleg was dead." Of all the MI6 officers, Veronica Price was emotionally the closest to Gordievsky. Ever since 1978, protecting him had been her most pressing duty, a daily preoccupation. Her manner remained brisk and businesslike, but she was deeply concerned. "I thought we had done all we could with the plans," she said. "Now it was up to the Moscow people to take over." Price did not hold with hand-wringing. Her ward, her special responsibility, had been lost, but she was confident he would be found and saved. Price had been told that the mosquitoes could be fierce on the Russian-Finnish border in early summer, so she bought some mosquito repellent. Viscount Roy Ascot, later to become an earl, was MI6 station chief in Moscow, and possibly the most blue-blooded spy Britain has ever produced. His great-grandfather had been Britain's prime minister. His paternal grandfather, after whom he was named, was a scholar and lawyer, one of the most brilliant of his generation, who was killed in the First World War. His father, the second Earl, had been a colonial administrator. People tend to either fawn over aristocracy or dismiss it.
Being posh is quite a good cover for spying, and Viscount Ascot was an exceptionally good spy. After joining MI6 in 1980, he learned Russian and was posted to Moscow in 1983 at the age of 31. Before leaving Britain, Ascot and his wife, Caroline, had been briefed on Pimlico. Spouses of serving officers were treated as additional unpaid adjuncts to the MI6 station and entrusted with high-grade secrets when necessary. The daughter of an architect, Caroline, Viscountess Ascot, was scholarly, imaginative, and unshakably discreet. The Ascots were shown a photograph of Gordievsky and drilled on the plans for making the brush contact and exfiltration. Veronica Price personally described Gordievsky to them without ever revealing his name, where he might be, or what he did. Everyone referred to him as Pimlico. Veronica was straight out of John le Carré. In her face, manner, and bearing, she described the man as quite simply a hero. She completely admired him and thought there was something unique about him. She told us, "Pimlico is an absolutely remarkable person." Over the previous 2 years of their Moscow posting, the Ascots had traveled by car to and from Helsinki several times, to familiarize themselves with the escape route and the rendezvous point. Just 5 people in Moscow knew of the escape plan. Ascot and his wife, his deputy Arthur G., an experienced officer who was soon due to take over from Ascot as head of station, and his wife, Rachel, and the MI6 secretary, Violet Chapman. All 5 lived in the expatriate compound on Kutuzovsky Prospect. Every month, one of the officers headed off to the central market to look out for a man with a Safeway bag. Whenever Gordievsky had returned home on leave, and for several weeks before and after, one of them had checked the signal site outside the bread shop on the other side of the avenue, every evening, rain or shine. The rotation was deliberately irregular. Violet could actually see the site from the stairwell outside her flat. When it was their turn, Ascot and G monitored the site on foot or when driving home. We had to ring the changes quite imaginatively, so a pattern didn't build up that could be spotted by those who we knew were watching us and listening. You can imagine the number of artificially cultivated and artificially broken conversations necessary to the timing of this maneuver. The team kept the stock of chocolate on hand, ready to give the recognition signal. Large numbers of stale, uneaten chocolate bars used to accumulate in our coat pockets, handbags, and glove compartments. Ascot acquired a lifelong aversion to Kit Kats. Ascot knew the escape plan by heart and did not think much of it. It was a complex plan, and we knew how flimsy the whole thing was. It seemed so unlikely it would happen. Operation Pimlico provided for the exfiltration of up to 4 people, 2 adults and 2 little girls. Ascot had 3 children of his own under 6 years old. Getting them to sit quietly on the back seat of his car was hard enough. How they would react to being stuffed in a trunk did not bear thinking about. Even if the spy managed to throw off the surveillance for long enough to reach the border, which seemed unlikely, the chances of the MI6 officers evading the KGB and reaching the rendezvous without being intercepted were, he calculated, almost exactly nil. The KGB was absolutely all over us. The flats of the diplomats were bugged, as were their cars and telephones. The KGB occupied the floor above. Every evening, you would see them carrying out their tapes in Red Cross boxes, having sat upstairs listening to us. They strongly suspected the presence of hidden cameras. Whenever Caroline went shopping, she had a 3-car convoy of KGB cars in attendance. Ascot himself was sometimes accompanied by no fewer than 5. The cars of suspected MI6 officers were sprayed with the same radioactive dust put on Gordievsky's shoes and clothes. If the dust turned up on the clothes of someone they suspected of spying for Britain, that would be proof of contact. In addition, the KGB sometimes sprayed the footwear of suspected spies with a chemical odor imperceptible to humans, but easily traced by sniffer dogs. Each MI6 officer kept 2 pairs of identical shoes, so that he could slip on an uncontaminated pair if necessary. Another pair was kept inside the station at the embassy, sealed in a plastic bag. These were known as doggy-proof shoes. The only way husband and wife could communicate at home was by passing notes, in bed, under the sheets. Usually these were written in fountain pen with soluble ink on toilet paper that could then be flushed. We were under constant watch. There was almost no privacy ever, anywhere. It was exhausting and quite stressful. Even in the embassy, the only place to be sure a conversation was not overheard was the safe speech room in the basement, a sort of porter cabin surrounded by noise within an empty space. The first sign of a change of tempo had come on Monday, May 20th, with a cable warning that Pimlico was now on high alert. "We sensed something was wrong," wrote Ascot. "We tried to resist this sense, but in contrast to the many weeks of the previous 3 years, we felt each night could be for real." A fortnight later, following the departure of Layla and the girls, a message from London urged that the signal site be monitored with even greater vigilance. "The telegrams said, 'Nothing to worry about,'" recalled Ascot. So there was clearly something to worry about. Gordievsky was waiting at the airport when his wife and children arrived back in Moscow. So was the KGB. Layla was in good spirits. An official from Aeroflot had accompanied Layla and the girls onto the plane in London, and another had greeted them at Moscow and escorted them from the first-class cabin. They were whisked to the front of the passport queue. Being the wife of the resident had its perks. She was relieved to see Gordievsky waiting at the arrivals barrier. "Great. He's all right," she thought. One look at Gordievsky's haggard face and haunted expression changed that. He looked terrible, stressed and tense. In the car, he explained, "I'm in big trouble. We can't go back to England." Layla was astonished. "Why on earth not?" Gordievsky took a deep breath and lied. "There is a plot against me, and tongues are wagging, but I'm innocent. Some conspiracy against me is brewing behind the scenes. Because I have been appointed resident, a good position with lots of applicants, certain people are out to get me. I'm in a very difficult position. Don't believe what you may hear about me. I'm not guilty of anything. I'm an honest officer, I'm a Soviet citizen, and I'm loyal." Layla had been brought up within the KGB and was familiar with the malicious gossip and intrigue that gusted around the center. Her husband had risen far and fast within the organization, so of course his devious and jealous colleagues would be out to get him. After the initial shock, Layla's natural optimism resurfaced. "I am practical, pragmatic, down to earth. Naive, maybe sometimes. I just accepted it. I was his wife. The plotting against him would subside, and his career would get back on track, as it had done before. He should try to relax and wait for the crisis to blow over. Everything would turn out all right." Layla did not notice the KGB car tailing them back from the airport. Gordievsky did not point it out. He did not tell his wife that he had been ordered to surrender his diplomatic passport, and that he was now on leave, indefinitely. Nor did he reveal that his box of Western books had been confiscated, and he had been instructed to sign a document admitting possession of anti-Soviet literature. For the hidden microphones, and Layla's benefit, he kept up the charade, loudly complaining of the injustice and the baseless plot against him. "It's an outrage to treat a KGB colonel like this." She did not know that his colleagues no longer met his eye, and that he sat at an empty desk all day. He did not tell her that their flat was bugged, or that they were under 24-hour KGB surveillance. He told her nothing, and she believed him. But Layla could see her husband was under intense psychological strain. He looked terrible, with hollow, bloodshot eyes. He had begun drinking Cuban rum, anesthetizing himself into sleep every night. He even took up smoking, trying to calm his raging nerves. In 2 weeks, he had lost 14 pounds. She made him see a doctor, a family friend, who was shocked at what she heard through the stethoscope. "What's wrong with you?" the doctor demanded. "Your heart beats irregular. You're frightened. What are you so scared of?" She prescribed sedatives. "He was like a beast in a cage," Layla recalled. "My role was to calm him down. I am your rock," I said. "Don't worry. Drink if you want to. I don't mind." At night, rum-sodden and panic-stricken, Gordievsky chewed over his limited options. Should he tell Layla? Should he try to make contact with MI6? Could he activate his escape plan and attempt to flee? But if he did so, should he take Layla and the girls too? On the other hand, he had survived the drugged interrogation and he had not been arrested. Was the KGB genuinely backing off? If they still did not have the evidence to haul him in, then an escape attempt would be foolish and premature. He would wake exhausted, no nearer a decision, head pounding and heart fluttering. It was his mother who persuaded him that he needed to take a break. The many perks of KGB membership included access to various health spas and holiday centers. One of the most exclusive of these was the sanatorium at Semyonovskoye, about 60 miles south of Moscow, built by the chairman of the KGB, Andropov, in 1971 for the rest and cure of leaders of the Communist Party and Soviet government. Still acting on the pretense that all was as it should be, the KGB authorities granted Gordievsky permission for a two-week stay at the spa. Before leaving, he called his old friend Mikhail Lyubimov, the former KGB resident in Copenhagen, now trying to make a living as a writer. "I'm back. It seems permanently," said Gordievsky in an uneven voice. They agreed to meet. "I was completely staggered by his appearance," wrote Lyubimov. "Pale as death, nervy, with fussy movements and confused speech." He explained his problems by saying that some books by Solzhenitsyn and other émigrés had been spotted in his London home. This had been reported by his enemies in the Residentura, and in Moscow it had been blown up into a serious issue. Lyubimov, ever buoyant, tried to cheer him up. "Forget it, man. Why not leave the KGB and write a book? You were always keen on history and you have a good brain." But Gordievsky seemed inconsolable, drinking glass after glass of vodka. "A new phenomenon," Lyubimov noted. "I always thought he was one of the few people in the KGB who didn't drink." Gordievsky said that he was going to a health farm to repair his nervous system, and then staggered off into the Moscow night. Lyubimov was worried enough about his old friend's state of mind to call Nikolai Gribin, with whom he remained on good terms. "What's wrong with Oleg? He's not the man he was. What has happened to bring him to this point?" Gribin muttered something about the KGB resort in Semyonovskoye, where an unsuccessful resident could be cured, and added, "He will be there soon." Then he rang off. As the date of his departure approached, Gordievsky reached a decision. Before leaving for the sanatorium, he would fly the signal at the central market, indicating that he needed to pass on a message. On his return, 3 Sundays later, he would go to the brush contact site at St. Basil's. He had not yet decided what message to send to MI6. He only knew he needed to make contact before he went mad. Meanwhile, the KGB investigators watched and probed, combing the files, interviewing everyone Gordievsky had worked with, searching out the clues that would prove his guilt and seal his fate. Budanov was prepared to be patient. He did not have to wait long. On June 13, 1985, Aldrich Ames committed one of the most spectacular acts of treason in the history of espionage. He named no fewer than 25 individuals spying for Western intelligence against the Soviet Union. In the month since his first payment from the KGB, Ames had arrived at a brutally logical conclusion. Any of the CIA's numerous spies inside Soviet intelligence could get wind of what he was up to and expose him. The only way to protect himself, therefore, was to reveal to the KGB any and every asset who could betray him, so the Russians could sweep them up and execute the lot. Then they would pose no threat. Ames knew he was issuing a death warrant for every person he named, but that, he reasoned, was the only way to ensure that he would be safe and rich. All of the people on my June 13th list knew the risks they were taking. If one of them learned about me, he would have told the CIA, and I would have been arrested and thrown in jail. It wasn't personal. It was simply how the game was played. That afternoon, Ames met Sergei Chuvakin in Chadwick's, a popular Georgetown restaurant, and handed him £7 of intelligence reports in a shopping bag, a vast trove of secrets he had amassed over the preceding weeks that would later become known, unromantically, as the Big Dump. Classified cables, internal memos, and agent reports. An espionage encyclopedia, a who's who that revealed the identity of every important Soviet intelligence officer working for the United States, and one working for the UK, to whom he had almost certainly alluded on their first meeting. And he provided a name, the MI6 spy the CIA had pinpointed 3 months earlier, and codenamed Tickle, was Oleg Gordievsky.
Burton Gerber claimed Ames had discovered the name coincidentally. Milton Bearden, soon to become Gerber's deputy in the Soviet section, alleges that Ames had done the detective work himself. Ames's intelligence bonanza was swiftly passed on to Moscow, and an enormous mopping-up operation began. At least 10 spies identified by Ames would perish at the hands of the KGB, and more than 100 intelligence operations were compromised. Soon after the big dump, Ames received a message via Chuvakin from Moscow. "Congratulations, you are now a millionaire." This was the evidence Budanov had been waiting for, proof positive of Gordievsky's treachery straight from the CIA. Yet still the KGB did not pounce. Quite why has never been fully established, but a combination of complacency, inattention, and overambition seems the most likely explanation. The counterintelligence directorate was preoccupied with rounding up the 24 spies identified by Ames. Budanov still wanted to catch Gordievsky in flagrante with MI6 to cause Britain maximum embarrassment. And anyway, under constant surveillance, Gordievsky could not possibly escape. On the morning of June 15, 1985, the third Saturday of the month, Gordievsky emerged from the flat, carrying a Safeway bag, and wearing the grey leather cap he had brought back from Denmark and a pair of grey trousers. He walked a quarter mile to the nearest shopping precinct, careful not to look behind for his tail, the first rule of evading surveillance. The lessons he had learned at School 101, 23 years earlier, were coming back. He entered a pharmacy and casually looked through the window while appearing to search the shelves, then to a savings bank on a second floor, which afforded a view of the street from the stairs, then a busy food shop. Next, he walked up a long, narrow alleyway between two blocks of flats, turned the corner and ducked into one of the blocks, climbed two flights of the communal stairs, and surveyed the street. No sign of surveillance, which did not mean it was not there. He walked on, rode a bus for a few stops, got off again, hailed a taxi, took a roundabout route to the apartment block where his younger sister, Marina, lived with her new husband. He climbed up the main stairs, passed the door of her apartment without knocking, and then went down the back staircase, sauntered into the metro and headed east, changed trains, alighted, crossed the platform, and headed west again. Finally, he reached the Central Market. At 11 a.m., he took up his post beneath the clock and pretended to be waiting for a friend. The place was thronged with Saturday morning shoppers, but he saw no one carrying a Harrods bag. After 10 minutes, he left. Had MI6 spotted his signal indicating he needed to make a brush contact at St. Basil's 3 Sundays hence, he would have to wait another 2 weeks before finding out if the signal had been picked up. 2 days later, Gordievsky found himself in a spacious room overlooking the Lopasnaya River, in one of Russia's most luxurious official resorts. But he also discovered he had a roommate, a man in his mid-60s who followed him everywhere. Many of the guests were clearly spies and stool pigeons, planted to watch and listen. Gordievsky had packed the Safeway bag in his luggage. Partly this was out of superstition, an unwillingness to be parted from his escape signal, but it was also a practical measure. He might need to get to the signal site in a hurry. One afternoon he found his roommate inspecting the treasured shopping bag. "Why have you got a foreign plastic bag?" the man asked. Gordievsky snatched it from his hands. "You never know when there might be something in the shops worth buying," he snapped. The next day, jogging in the woods, he spotted surveillance officers lurking in the undergrowth who hurriedly turned their backs and pretended to be urinating. Semyonovskoye Sanatorium was, in reality, an extremely comfortable prison where the KGB could keep a close eye on Gordievsky and wait for him to drop his guard. The sanatorium had a good library, containing a number of map books. Surreptitiously, he studied the border region between Russia and Finland, trying to memorize its contours. He ran every day, building up his fitness. The more he thought about the escape, the less impractical it seemed. Slowly, through the paralyzing fog of fear, he was inching toward a decision. "There's no alternative. If I don't get out, I'm going to die. I'm as good as a dead man on holiday." Chapter 13. The Dry Cleaner. Gordievsky returned from the Semyonovskoye Sanatorium, refreshed, apprehensive, but also, for the first time since his return to Russia, resolute. He must escape. He would first alert his British friends that the KGB was onto him by passing a written message at the brush contact site in St. Basil's, then fly the Pimlico escape signal and flee. The chances of success were vanishingly small. If he had been betrayed by a mole inside MI6, then the KGB would be lying in wait. Perhaps they were expecting him to make exactly this move, and preparing a trap. But at least he would die trying, no longer ensnared in the hellish web of surveillance and suspicion, waiting for the investigators to move in. Risking his own life was the easier part of that decision. What about his family? Should he try to take Layla and his daughters with him, or leave them behind? During a decade of spying, he had made many hard choices, but nothing remotely as agonizing as this. A decision pitting loyalty against prudence, a choice between survival and love. He found himself intently studying his daughters, now aged 5 and 3, and trying to imprint them on his memory. Maria, now known as Masha, so active and bright, a natural athlete like her father. Plump little Anna, fascinated by animals and insects. At night he heard the girls talking in their beds, in English.
"I don't like it here," Masha told her younger sister. "Let's go back to London."
Did he dare to take them with him when he tried to escape? Sensing her husband's inner turmoil, but ignorant of its real cause, Layla told her mother-in-law that she feared Oleg was having some sort of crisis, triggered by trouble at work. Ever practical, Olga Gordievsky advised her to distract him with small projects, odd jobs around the house, and fixing the car. Layla did not press him for explanations, or reprimand him for his drinking, though it alarmed her deeply. Her gentle solicitude, her instinctive sense that the man she loved was going through some private inner hell he could not share, made the looming decision all the harder to bear. Including Layla and the girls in the escape plan would radically increase the probability of failure. Gordievsky was trained to evade surveillance, whereas they were not. A family of 4 was far more conspicuous than a single man traveling alone. However heavily sedated, his daughters might wake up in the car trunks. They might cry or suffocate. They would certainly be terrified. If they were caught, innocent Layla would be considered complicit in his espionage and treated accordingly. She would be interrogated, imprisoned, or worse, and certainly ostracized. His daughters would be pariahs. He had chosen this path, and they had not. What right did he have to expose them to such danger? Gordievsky was a gruff father and a demanding husband, but a doting one. The thought of abandoning his family caused him such anguish that he found himself gasping, doubled up in physical pain. If he did manage to get away, perhaps the British could eventually persuade the Kremlin to release his family to the West. Spy swaps were part of the established Cold War arithmetic, but that could take years, if it ever happened at all. He might never see his family again. Perhaps it was better to take the chance and try to escape together, as a family, whatever the outcome, regardless of the danger. At least they would succeed or fail together. But into that thought wriggled a worm of doubt. Spies trade in trust. Over a lifetime of espionage, Gordievsky had developed a knack for detecting loyalty, suspicion, conviction, and faith. He loved Layla, but he did not entirely trust her, and in one part of his heart, he feared her. The daughter of a KGB general, steeped in propaganda from childhood, Layla was a loyal and unquestioning Soviet citizen. She had enjoyed her exposure to Western life, but never fully immersed herself in it as he had. Would she put her political responsibility above marital loyalty? In all totalitarian cultures, the individual is encouraged to consider the interests of society before personal welfare. From Nazi Germany to Communist Russia to Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge and North Korea today, a willingness to betray those nearest to you for the greater good was the ultimate mark of committed citizenship and ideological purity. If he revealed himself to Layla, would she renounce him? If he told her of the escape plan and asked her to join him, would she refuse? Would she denounce him? It is a mark of how far ideology and politics had corrupted human instinct that Gordievsky could not be sure whether his wife's love was stronger than her communism or vice versa. He attempted a litmus test. One evening, on the balcony of their apartment, out of reach of the microphones, he attempted to sound out the loyalties